Welcome to a new series of Great Lives. Now, joining me today to choose our great life is the explorer Sir Ranulph Fiennes. Ranulph Fiennes is the first in history to reach the world's highest peak and to cross both the world's ice caps. He's led scores of expeditions, his honours being not just for his achievements, but also because on the way to breaking records, he's raised over £14 million for charity. He's just written a book, Mad Dogs and Englishmen, An Expedition Round My Family, which traces the Fiennes family back through history. Fiennes from England fought Fiennes from France at Agincourt, it seems, and this may be what has inspired his choice of a great life today. Ranulph, tell us who that is.
I'm going to choose Henry V, to whom I am related, because Henry V's mother was Mary de Bohun, and she was the direct descendant of Maud de Fiennes.
Henry V. Images of the great king jostle in our minds. Olivier exhorting his troops with that totally famous speech in the 1944 film, Kenneth Branagh's more recent and more bloody portrayal, and that famous profile portrait of Henry with the uncompromising pudding bowl haircut. Ranulph, what in particular do you admire about your ancestor, Henry V?
He was the best possible soldier. Wonderful military abilities combined with no stuffiness. You're right in there with the lowest soldier and sharing their sufferings. Pretty unique amongst big generals, even today. I suppose I never met my father, but he was killed in the Second World War. He commanded at the Battle of Alamein, commanded the regiment at the landings in Salerno. He was wounded five times, and I joined the same regiment, and there were still lots of Scottish soldiers in the regiment who remembered my father, and that's exactly what they said about him as their commanding officer. He would be out there in the desert, he had the same fly sores as them, and he wouldn't be one for sitting in the officer's mess tent sort of thing. He'd be out checking them at their tanks right the way through the war. And to me, then, reading about Henry V, I'm in the back of my mind thinking about my father as well.
Like all great men, the reality becomes encrusted with myth. With us today to help separate fact from myth, we have Dr. Juliet Barker. She's a literary biographer, medieval historian, and an authority on Henry V. Her book, Agincourt, The King, The Campaign, The Battle, was on the best-selling history books list of 2006. Its sequel, Conquest, was published just a few weeks ago. Juliet, you've immersed yourself in the world of Henry V and in the Battle of Agincourt. Tell us what kind of a man you see there.
I think the main thing about Henry V is that he was an entirely focused person. He came to the throne with a burden of guilt upon his shoulders because his father had usurped the throne. The kingdom was virtually on the brink of civil war. There were loads of problems with heretics, with dissident people in the realm, and Henry V knew that if he didn't pull it all together very quickly, then the realm would just disintegrate into civil war. And what he was so good at doing was going in there and sorting out the problems. He got Parliament on his side. He was wonderful at working with the institutions that were already there and making them work for him. He spent 2 years sorting out the problems of England before he invaded France.
I'm going to read a contemporary description of Henry written by the French ambassador that you, Juliet, have translated for us.
That's right, and it's the enemy describing Henry V, not people who were on his side at all.
Here's an enemy's view of Henry V. Although at first sight he gave the impression of being a proud prince, being a man of distinguished bearing and good height, he showed the greatest affability, which he valued above all other virtues, to all people, whatever their rank or status. He always avoided wordy replies and commonplace oaths, going straight to the point and contenting himself with saying, "It is impossible," or "That's how it should be." He thought that such simple statements should be considered just as effective as if he had sworn upon Christ and all the saints. He knew how to serve the cause of justice, sparing the lowly and humbling the powerful. He was as amazingly calm in adversity as in prosperity, and if anything bad happened to his soldiers, he would often repeat to them, "As you know, the fortunes of war vary, but if you desire a good outcome, you must keep your courage intact." He sounds an extraordinary man. He wasn't born to be king, was he, Julia?
No, he wasn't, no. He was born to be the son of Henry of Lancaster, and he was meant to be the great future Duke of Lancaster. And that's the point, is that because Henry the Fourth overthrew Richard the Second, it changed his circumstances completely.
The year of his birth?
1386. And we know that because he had his horoscope cast. He had the same upbringing as most princes of his generation, and he was highly literate. He could read Latin, French and English. He had a massive library of books that he collected over the period, and he studied history. You have to remember, he was a soldier at the age of 13. He was fighting in Wales, and not just fighting, but taking a command position. He learnt the art of siegecraft. He learnt the art of guerrilla warfare. He learnt how to finance, and most important of all, he learnt all about the logistics of campaigning, and this was one of the reasons why he was such a successful soldier on the field.
Juliet has just been saying that he fought from the age of 13. Ranulf, do we mature later now, or can you imagine being led by somebody aged 13?
Yeah, he earned his spurs against the Welsh, Owen Glendower, year after year, marching around in the mud of Wales against guerrilla forces, really. I think if I knew, like his soldiers must have done, that by the time he was in command, he had done nothing wrong. He'd not killed a whole load of people, like many generals do. If that was the case, then I would definitely support him. I wouldn't be an ageist.
Do you think these qualities are inborn in a person? Obviously, they're learned in the sense that they can be developed through experience, but at the age of 12 or 13, do you think there are some boys and perhaps girls who can be great warriors and some who never could?
Well, absolutely, but they skip generations. I mean, if you look at Henry VI, he went, as far as I'm concerned, wasn't any good at all.
Absolutely not. Useless.
And you, Juliet, who admire not just his qualities as a warrior, but his qualities as a king and a politician. Mm. How important do you think was the early soldiering to the development of those skills?
I think it's absolutely critical to the development of his skills. And he builds a very close-knit team around him as Prince of Wales. And those men are around him all the time for the rest of his reign and beyond his reign as well. They are guarding his legacy. But also, he learns this ability to empathise with the common soldier as well. Most great generals, while their soldiers are out in the field, are out at the back, sitting in a tent. Henry V always led from the front. He shared his own soldiers' privations, and he was with them from the front all the time. And they knew that, and they knew that he would live and die with them. And that won him the unswerving support of the common man.
This alloy of qualities of leadership and command with qualities of comradeship and camaraderie, in a sense, it's every boy's dream to be a good mate to his mates, but also to be a commander. And there are inherent contradictions between being able to be both. It's almost a Jungian stereotype in the collective unconscious of the monarch who you could imagine dropping in for tea and being friendly, and being just like you, and yet the monarch who in all her or his glory can sit on the throne and command in the most imperious manner.
There's a wonderful story of when he's got... There were so many warring people in his own kingdom that he got two of these gentry who'd been fighting each other for years, and he sat them down and he said, "I'm going to eat my tea now. If you haven't made up by the end of the tea, I'm going to hang you both." and they were so terrified of him that they did.
I think it would work well in modern politics. Ranulf, do you think all the stuff about Hotspur and the carousing and the lawlessness when he was younger and the almost Damascene change to Hal, do you think that's exaggerated by Shakespeare, or is there truth in it?
Everything I've read says that he was that way inclined, quite a few Prince of Waleses later on.
I'm afraid I don't agree. I think this is part of the legend, the myth of Henry V that was built up afterwards, and it helps to explain why he was such a great king, the idea that he put his awful past behind him. But if you read contemporary chronicles, he's too busy. He's involved in the court and he's involved in government, and there's no question, there's never a single story in any of the contemporary chronicles of him crossing that line and being the sort of sot that Shakespeare makes him out to be. It's a good story. And it's meant to be a sort of an allegory of what a king should be. He's put off his childish things and he has become the man and the great king.
Like Ranulf, I think I'd rather believe the story.
I'm very sad to hear that he didn't enjoy his oats.
Well, I continue to believe that he did, or might have. The French, because most of his kingship is concerned with war in France. Why? Why war in France? What was all that about?
He arrived at a time when he could afford to fight, and the barons at that time lived to fight, and the people they loved to fight most were the French. So Henry V, there he was in a perfect position for attacking France, and he considered himself to be the King of France as well as the King of England, because they'd taken on the Plantagenet's name, basically.
He believed that he was not only the divinely ordained King of England, and that he had to prove that to his subjects, and to prove that God was on his side and that he wasn't from an illegitimate line of kings. He had to do grand gestures that would show that God had fought for him. And one of the great ways of doing that was to combine all his warring English subjects and take them out of the kingdom and take them against the common enemy, the French. The other thing is that he genuinely believed that he had a genuine claim to the throne of France, which he did do through Edward III, his great-grandfather. And much of Henry's career is actually defined by Edward III's early career in France. It was Edward III who claimed the throne and who was actually the legitimate heir, if you want certain views.
Which takes us to Agincourt. I sense from what you say, Ranulph, that it is first as a warrior that you admire him.
Yes, exactly. As far as I'm concerned, second to none. He had a meticulous preparation for doing it. He had a fleet of 1,500 ships, which he requisitioned from all over the place, which is 12 times the size of the Spanish Armada. And when he got to Harfleur, had to do away with it. So he besieged that eventually successfully, but whilst he was doing it, a large amount of his army of 10,000 got the bloody flux or dysentery. They were wet, they were cold, they were hungry, his 6,000 men. They were cutting the back of their leather breeches off in order to stop them rotting with the bloody flux, which I might say on polar expeditions is called crutch rot. And but we don't cut the back of our Gore-Tex trousers off. And so he kept them going.
There's a telling episode in your book, Juliet, about the kind of military leader that Henry was to his troops. Will you read it to us?
This is when Henry V is in command of the siege of Harfleur. And one of the contemporary chroniclers says of the time, "The king daily and nightly in his own person visited and searched the watches, orders and stations of every part of his host, and whom he found diligent he praised and thanked, and the negligent he corrected and chastised." And there's rather a nice little sort of corollary to that as well, because there was a 15-year-old boy who was on the French side, and he heard rumours, and he reports it in his chronicle, saying that King Henry, who was very cunning, often went around the town in disguise to identify the weakest and most suitable place by which he could take it. So there you can see the beginnings of the legend of the little touch of Harry in the night scene that's so famous in Shakespeare, where Henry goes around the army in disguise.
What would you think the key to that surprising victory was?
I don't think there is just one reason. He had the logistical skill to ensure that his archers had enough arrows to shoot significant numbers to mow down the French as they advanced. He also had gone out the night before and checked the field, so he knew it was a muddy field, and he knew he had to make the French, who are heavily armoured, unlike his own men, advance across that field of mud, because that would wear them out and make them vulnerable to his arrows. And thirdly, he's there in the thick of it. He commands the central battalion of the men. He's there wearing his crown on the top of his helm. All his men know he's there. He's fighting on foot with them, and they know that he will die as they will die as well. And I think possibly the most crucial thing of all is that he took the decision to advance his army, and Henry took that decision because he knew that he was losing his men's courage.
Ralph, do you think you'd have been fighting alongside your fine ancestors in battle if you'd been born in a different era? Do you envy them a little bit? In some ways, I can imagine you in the 15th century.
Yeah, I mean, I would like to have been an archer. And Juliet was saying about the heavily armed French, but there were obviously also some heavily armed Brits, and one was the Duke of York, who was fighting in the front line, got pushed over and fell in a puddle. A couple of others fell on him, and when the battle ended, he, the Duke of York's body, was found totally uninjured, but dead from suffocation in the puddle.
That was what happened to most of the French in the front line, because they were pushed over by the sheer numbers on the French side, and they were all struggling to get there, and there were all the princes in the front line. And because they're having to bow their heads because they've got this great hail of arrows coming upon them, they actually described as the sky darkening over because there are so many arrows coming at them. So they fall, they're pushed over, and most of the great lords died of suffocation in the battle.
Ralph, I want to ask you about St. Crispin's night, that cold night before the battle. You've led plenty of expeditions. I, in a much more pathetic and amateurish way, have led small groups. And I think we probably both know that you can go and must go so far in persuading people that they're going to win and it's OK and it's doable and, yes, we can all do it together. But you mustn't go too far or they stop believing in you.
Well, that becomes much, much more difficult if their morale is down. And the night before, their mood must have been very sombre, because they'd seen the size of the army blocking their route. They were outnumbered by at least 4-1, and Henry had ordered silence in his camp instead of beating the drums to make them happier. You can imagine the apprehension of the English soldiers. There were 6,000 men, mostly archers, with the Brits, against 25,000, mostly men-at-arms, plus 1,200 cavalry on the French side. So you'd have to have words of huge exhortation, and you'd have to get it exactly right, and you'd have to be hugely admired, venerated by your men, to raise the morale from a situation like that.
Are you good at it? Do you give pep talks on the eve of difficult times?
The only times I've been fighting against people that were going to shoot back was when I was the only Brit with 60 Arabs, and it was at night, and we were completely in enemy territory, and I kept them quiet only because I thought that we hadn't been detected being in the middle of enemy territory. The secret there was to split them up into tiny groups, noiseless groups, which is what I did. And we got through to dawn, and the opposition then came up where we hoped they would, so that was lucky rather than cleverness on my part, and we were able to get away alive.
Do you talk to people? Do you inspire them? Does it matter what a leader says to his men?
Well, I really only did it with Arabs, in Arabic, so quite how my Arabic, which I'd learnt in Beaconsfield, went over in terms of exhortation, I can't really comment, but I did my best.
This is BBC Radio 4. I'm Matthew Paris, and you're listening to Great Lives, where my guest, the explorer Sir Ranulph Fiennes, has chosen King Henry V, and our expert witness is Dr. Juliet Barker. We were talking of Agincourt, but there we see a glimpse of that rationality in Henry that tipped into coldness, verging, I would submit, on cruelty. Henry allowed the slaughter of French prisoners after Agincourt, probably numbering hundreds. Juliet, do you think that can be justified?
Absolutely, I'm afraid. In terms of a humanitarian gesture, no, of course it can't be, and no one would ever want to kill prisoners. The point is that he gave the order to kill the prisoners at the point in the battle when he thought he'd won, and then suddenly there's a rally on the French side and there's an attack from the rear. If the French prisoners had then chosen to pick up the arms and armour that were lying around the field and then attacked and joined in the attack on them, the English would have been surrounded. There were so few of them. And the interesting thing is that none of his contemporaries condemned him for it. They all said it was a sensible military decision. And had he not taken that decision, who knows but that he might not have lost the battle.
Is that right, Ranulph?
Well, I know that the troops weren't overjoyed at being told to throat cut all these guys because they were losing good money because they could ransom a lot of the people that they killed.
Absolutely. So there's no point in doing it unless you absolutely have to.
I'm trying to find any battle in which either of you think that Henry went a little bit too far or was a little bit brutal. And I think, Juliet, that you wouldn't defend his behaviour at Rouen towards
no.
the civilian population. Explain what happened.
Well, in 1417, 2 years after Agincourt, because Agincourt was a dry run, really, for the big invasion of France, he went back to France and he laid siege to the city of Rouen. The people of Rouen, for months on end, were under siege. They were starving. So what they did was to throw out all the women and children and all the sick and the elderly from the garrison, expecting that Henry V would let them pass through the army and go off. They couldn't afford to feed them anymore. Henry V refused to allow them to pass. And those men and women and children died, starved to death, in the ditch, between the English army and the French under siege. And for me, that's the unforgivable blot on Henry's character and his career.
A bit over the top, Ranulph?
No, I don't agree with you. That is another example of what was acceptable at that time, except a bit more difficult to defend, I have to admit. When that Rouen garrison surrendered, Normandy could now be said to be the property of the English King Henry the Conqueror, 350 years after William the Conqueror and the Battle of Hastings, so we got our own back.
Yeah, but a fairly temporary getting of our own back, wasn't it?
You don't have to remember that. We're talking about Henry V.
We held that kingdom for 30 years. Most people forget that.
That's not very long.
It is a substantial length of time.
Was it worth it? That's my question, really. What was it worth, these huge battles, to get back little bits of France that, in the end, we weren't able to hold on to?
I think Henry let his ambition run away with him. Mm. I think if he had gone into France, conquered Normandy and been content with Normandy, I think we could possibly still rule Normandy and Gascony today, like we have the Channel Islands. But because he was tempted by the prospect of a bigger prize, the crown, then that is what actually brought the seeds of its own destruction.
But does it matter to you, really,
well,
Ranulph,
whether... When you say 30 years, I mean, holding it for 30 years, that's a lifetime in those days.
Mm. Yes.
So you mustn't be rude about him on that count, Matthew.
I think you just admire the military prowess. You admire the doing of it, whether there was any long-term point in the doing of it or not.
Well, nobody holds anything forever. I mean, the Roman Empire collapsed, but you can hold for your lifetime, you know.
Is that how you psych yourself up for the various challenges in which you've emerged triumphant, not to think about whether the record is forever, not even to think about whether it really matters, but just to see the challenge and...
No, I mean, in my case, I've had 30 years of trouble with the Norwegians, not the French, and they have been a pain in the neck. And plus the fact that if you're first, if you do the first unsupported crossing of the Antarctic continent, it's a record which the Norwegians cannot thereafter break.
Mm.
It's only if you do it fastest that someone can do it faster. But if you're first, you're first, and that's it. And once Henry V was dead, his reputation, King of England and France, got his own back on William the Conqueror, great.
It was around this time that Henry meets his wife, Catherine of Valois. What are the circumstances?
Well, Henry V had decided he was going to marry Catherine even before he came to the throne of England. He'd never met her. She was a child. She was many years younger than him. But he knew he wanted to marry a princess of France, and she was basically the only one available. And it was because he wanted to strengthen his claim to the French throne, and he knew that if he married a French princess, their child would have a much better claim to the joint kingdoms of England and France. There was obviously some liking there, but she wasn't with him most of the time. Shakespeare's portrayal of the wooing of Catherine by Henry is a delightful scene, but it's totally untrue because, of course, Henry was fluent in French just as he was in English.
When he came back to England and ruled as king, he was known as a Prince of Justice.
Yes, he allowed no man to get away with favours or anything, that he always walked that straight line of justice. And that mattered at that time because no other prince of that period was like that. And it was very much a part of his conceived role of himself in this God-given role. He had to please God by doing justice to his subjects so that he would be the victorious king.
The next stage of his war plan didn't go so well.
Henry V goes back to France and invades again in 1417, sweeps all before him. He then forces the king to accept him as his son-in-law and heir to the throne of France, disinheriting the Dauphin. But by doing that, he becomes a part of the civil war in France, and it just becomes an endless series of sieges. And at Meaux, he became ill and eventually died of the dysentery.
And he was only 36. Do you feel you've got to know him while writing about him, Juliet?
Yes, I do. But I think you have to understand the medieval mindset to understand why he was regarded as such a golden hero, one of the greatest kings that had ever ruled England. And it wasn't just because of his eloquence, because we know from contemporary sources that he wasn't eloquent at all. One of my favourite things of all is Shakespeare's great speeches that he puts in Henry V's mouth. We know that when Henry actually launched the Battle of Agincourt, all he said was, "Fellas, let's go." He was a man of few words, and I like that.
"Fellas, let's go." I like that one.
My thanks to our guest this week, Sir Ranulph Fiennes, who chose the great life of King Henry V, and to our expert witness, Dr. Juliet Barker. Goodbye.